I'm joined in the studio now by vocalist Marnie Nixon. The work of hers that is probably familiar to the largest group of people is her work dubbing for the leading ladies in three musical films for women who didn't really sing themselves. She sang for Natalie Wood in West Side Story, for Deborah Carr in The King and I, and for Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. Marnie Nixon has also performed with many symphony orchestras and has made recordings of the works of Schoenberg, Stravinsky, Webern, and others. Her most recent album on the RCA record label is called The Cabaret Songs of Arnold Schoenberg, 1893 to 1903. She's also presently the host of an Emmy Award-winning TV show in California, which is called Boomerang. She's in Philadelphia today to perform this evening at the Abington Township Adult School. Her performance is the first in their celebrity series. Before we speak with Marnie Nixon, we're going to hear one of the Schoenberg cabaret songs that she sings on an album of his work. Marnie Nixon sang from her album of Schoenberg cabaret songs. It's called Nine Early Songs, and it's from the years of 1893 to 1903. Marnie Nixon is my guest in the studio now. We're going to be talking about her work singing people like Schoenberg and Webern, also her work dubbing for movies. Again, she is in Philadelphia this evening to perform at the Abington Township Adult School, and for any ticket information about that performance, you can call 659-4284. Well, welcome to Fresh Air, Marnie. Good pleasure to have you here. I'd like to start by talking about the Schoenberg music that you so recently recorded. I was myself very surprised when I first saw the album, having no idea that Arnold Schoenberg wrote cabaret songs.
Well, everyone was surprised. And as a matter of fact, we almost didn't get the record published, not published, recorded, because submitted the cabaret songs to Deutsche Grammophon, and they came back with an announcement that they did not want the great Schoenberg's image defiled, that would make him too human, and that they didn't want any part of it, which is a bit of snobbery, which I hate. And actually, it was Leonard Stein, who was the pianist on the record, who was a marvelous historian and has written many pieces on contemporary music, who found them in Larry Schoenberg's, Larry is Schoenberg's son, in Larry Schoenberg's, there was a cabinet in the back. They were moving and happened to find these songs, and he had just put them aside and never wanted them published, and or just thought it wasn't politic, I guess, in those days.
How did you come to record the album?
Well, it was Leonard Stein, whom I have... he was one of the first people whom I worked with in Los Angeles, where I grew up. And in those days, I was around a little clique of Leonard Stein, who then presented me to Stravinsky, and we had a concert series called the Monday Evening Concerts, and we did Charles Ives and tried out a lot of things. And he was my first piano teacher at Los Angeles City College, and we just did a lot of things together, and a lot of Schoenberg together, too, with Robert Kraft and Stravinsky things, and, well, I already said that. Anyway, he so over the years, we've collaborated on a lot of works, and when he found these pieces, he just thought that I would be just right for them, and he said, I'd like you to do them. And let's work them up. So I had exclusive right to them, and I was very thrilled. I was the first one to ever sing them. They had some of them had been performed in the cabaret, but others had been written for the cabaret but had never been performed.
When I think of German cabaret songs, I think of I guess Marlene Dietrich straddling a chair and singing some.
But that's
really
1930.
Yeah, I
that's
know.
1930
this is
cabaret,
1900,
and that's a difference.
1903. Yeah. And the lyrics, the English translations of the lyrics that you sing are for the most part very sweet and ethereal about the beauty of love, the grace of love.
Yes. Well, they're actually quite they're quite erotic, and there's kind of a double entendre there. The next one you hear is about fellow who has a girlfriend who sits all day long petting her black pussy on her. And, you know, you have to be very careful about translating that. But it is very sweet. And of course, in those days, the kind of real out-and-out vulgarity that we think of maybe as being erotic or vulgar just didn't exist. These were satirical songs. They came out of the literary cabaret, where all the poets and all the writers would come, and with slight sarcasm and sophistication, they were all always sung by real singers, so that you have the soprano who's dressed up as a man with the top hat and cane, maybe, but it was accepted that usually the women sang both men and women's kinds of songs, so you have a somebody with a voice who was singing them. In other words, not like in the 1930s, sometimes they had people who, like Marlene Dietrich, who really wasn't that type of singer. Was more of a talking, more of a smoky kind of atmosphere. This was very high class.
In the cover for the Schoenberg album, you appear on it dressed in a black man's suit with a mm-hmm. white shirt, a black top hat, white gloves. Why did women singers, dress in men's clothing, in very stark men's clothing for cabarets?
Well, I think precisely for that, so that they could, first of all, it would be a real costume, but then they could put on the characterization of a man without having to explain that they were singing songs that a man would sing. Go back and forth. You could just take off, or you could even have the jacket on, and then you could put the feather boa on, and then with various props and very simple means, you could play different roles.
Is it a song a man would sing simply because it's obviously a man singing about a woman, or is it meant to be a song a man would sing because of the sentiments expressed, because of sarcasm or tarred love, sentiments that perhaps
sometimes were too powerful
for women to sing?
It made it more acceptable for a woman to sing things that they didn't like women to sing, put them in a different category, and you get it removed into kind of a like we would call nowadays kind of campy. You'd get the campy feeling without having to talk about it. It was a very subtle approach, I think.
Do you dress in those clothes now if you're going to give a performance of Schoenberg's Cabaret songs?
Yes, I usually try to set up a whole atmosphere with a stage setting of furniture of that era, a love seat and various things, and I stage them when I do those particular songs, and I use different props, canes and hats and just to give a little atmosphere. And sometimes Leonard Stein and I have done it so that he actually becomes Ernst von Wolzogen, who was the leader of this Überbrettl theater. And I wrote the whole dialogue so that he actually then gets up from the piano, becomes Wolzogen, and then sits down and actually plays at the piano with me with the top hat and the costumes. And it's kind of fun.
You had said before that Deutsche Grammophon expressed their reluctance to record this because it might degrade the very intellectual image of Schoenberg. Has anyone expressed that to you after a concert, that you somehow defiled his purest musical standing?
No. Nobody has really ever said that. I mean, marvelous musicians, and we had... I've lost his name now. One of the leading publishers in Berlin, listening to the record and just being absolutely delighted. We've gotten marvelous reviews in Europe, all over. People were concerned, of course, that me being from California could get the flavor of the German language, but I guess that seems to be one of my flares. I am very good at languages, and I was coached extensively, and I did the songs for a couple years with various people, and getting it perfected, and it's been very nicely received.
Well, we're going to hear some more songs from that album a little later this afternoon, but right now we're going to hear an excerpt of an album that was recorded a little earlier with Ernest Gold, who I believe set the poems of various American poets to music. We're going to be hearing something with lyrics, well, with poem, by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Do you want to say a few words about this piece and about the album, Marnie?
Well, this piece was, this song cycle was written for me. It's not the usual cycle because the pieces can be sung separately. Well, I guess maybe that is usual, but it's various phases of a woman's development, the beginning of love and a parting, and then what remains, and how you take that the rest of your life, and they're beautifully orchestrated. I've done them with Ernest many times. He happens to be my ex-husband. I was married to him for 19 years. Mother of the father of all my children. Well, that's interesting. We had a marvelous time recording these with the Vienna Volksoper. They're a marvelous orchestra, and it was very thrilling to me to be appearing with them, I must say. What else can I say? I like them very much.
Did it give you great pleasure to be singing the words of poets like Shelley and Emily Dickinson?
I'm a romanticist at heart, and so is Ernest. I really, all that sentiment, and it just can ooze all I want, all at once. I love it.
Okay, well, let's hear Marnie Nixon singing music, When Soft Voices Die.
Music, when
We heard Marnie Nixon from an album called Songs of Love and Parting, written for her by Ernest Gold. Marnie Nixon is in the studio with me now, and again, she's in Philadelphia to perform this evening at the Abington Township Adult School. We've been talking about a recent recording that she made of Arnold Schoenberg's cabaret songs, and as I mentioned earlier, many people have heard Marnie Nixon sing in movies and on albums, in places for which she wasn't really given all that much credit when she dubbed for other women in movies, for Natalie Wood in West Side Story, for Deborah Carr in The King and I, and for Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. Marnie, let me ask you, are you kind of morally opposed to a casting, someone who's responsible for casting someone in a starring role in a musical film who cannot sing?
Yes. no, really, I think that there are enough talented people around that can be beautifully photographed, that are good actresses, that really also sing. Now, I can understand that sometimes somebody who can't sing gets cast, but then I don't understand why there shouldn't be credit given to the vocalist. Their theory, of course, is that it will take away from the illusion and it will hurt the box office. But I think it's the way it's approached. I don't believe that at all. A lot of the pictures like South Pacific that were produced by, Otto Preminger, he gave credit to all the singers. I mean, he had Jojo Tozzi.
That's right, and the credits
singing
are listed
for Rossano
at the
Brazzi,
end of the film.
And that doesn't take away. I mean, after all, they give credit to the hairdresser and to the stuntman. And what when you're in the movie, who thinks of that when you're seeing the movie? You know, it's just, I think it's just not very polite.
I remember I was just really surprised when I understood how all that worked, that there were secretly people singing for the for the leading ladies, and no one was going to really tell you about.
Well, but actually, when I did the work, I've always been doing concerts, I've always been doing recitals, I've always been doing shows and roles on my own, so that when I did those jobs, it never occurred to me to feel put down. I mean, it was just being on the West Coast for most of my career, I had the problem of really having to scrounge and really subsidize my own career, which wasn't the dubbing. I mean, that was just a job that I picked up. And I say being in Los Angeles, it's because really to be in the mainstream of, if you're starting an operatic or a concert or recital career, you should be on the East Coast. It still remains, although I resent that too, and it's changing a little. But so the dubbing jobs were just marvelous jobs, well paid, and you got to work with marvelous actresses and wonderful directors that I, in those days, wouldn't have been able to work with. And it never occurred to me that my ego would be put down or anything. It was only after My Fair Lady that I began to see the value that I was giving to the picture, and seeing that it really that morally it was not right not to get credit, and then of course started the now I feel like I'm being haunted myself, even though I was a ghost, because it's that. It was a double-edged sword. I became well-known, as the Time magazine said, the ghostest with the mostest, bad rhyme. But you weren't in the inn unless you knew that secret. So that actually I got more publicity that way, I think, because I didn't. They got behind me like an underdog and promoted that, except that that became so important. People all over the world knew that. But they thought that I was a show singer, when in actuality, that really wasn't what I had been. So then, of course, started this multiple kind of crazy career that I've had, which is really typically American. And I began to see the facility that I had doing all sorts of different things. And at one point it became a really difficult problem. But now I find I can reap the benefits of that. It's quite unique, and now I can narrow down very easily and pick out the plums of where I want to go, but in my own way and on my own terms.
Yeah, I know sometimes people in the classical music end of things don't approve of singing or performing with, you know, more popular forms of music, whether it's on the stage or in movies. I guess that is changing because there's so many crossovers, many well-respected crossovers.
Yes, it's changing, and it's not only because of economics. The opera companies are having to produce lighter things. Light opera, operetta, God forbid, they say, you know, as if it was a poorer cousin of opera. Now, I know some gorgeous operettas. You have to be almost a better singer in operetta to really do good operetta singing than you do in opera sometimes. Maybe not as huge a voice, but, I mean, that's neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned. The bigness of a voice does not make a good singer. And so now they suddenly are looking at lighter things to help them bring in the audience. Mm-hmm. And now what I'm trying to do is to present a crossover, sort of a recital, and I have a kind of unique opportunity to do that, to present to the poor people who have been... Am I making a big speech? Is it too much? to help these poor people who suddenly have been accosted with culture, you know, quote unquote, and it's supposed to be something removed from your experience. It's supposed to be intellectually satisfying, and God forbid it should touch your heart or you have a gut reaction. I don't believe that's really what culture is all about. And there are a lot of people who want to really ennoble their experiences by the arts, which is really what the function of art is, as far as I'm concerned. And they want to really be moved. They want to be transported into another world and to make some kind of beauty out of this terrible existence that can be. And yet they're prevented from doing so because they have no education. And they think, oh, well, I don't understand culture, or I don't understand that music, and so it's going to be a drag to go to this concert. And what I would like to do, it's sort of like a form of education, is to try to bring those people into that world in a very informal way, and like you would in your living room. And like when I was a child, we had house music all the time, and we played, and everybody joined along, and so it... You know, so you didn't. It wasn't perfect, but at least you got so that you could really play the music. You could experience. You could get in it, and then you could go to the artist and you could listen to somebody who could really do it well. And then you have listeners who really just want to come and experience something. And then so sometimes the kind of music you would sing, instead of singing the greatest song you know of, you maybe then choose the greatest, most favorite song. You know, so you hit a place where they have a relevance to react to it. And then they can see that, I mean, people generally don't know what's classical, what's popular. They can see, well, this is a classical song. That was written by Mozart. That was written by Beethoven. My gosh, that was beautiful. That moved me. That was just what I feel. So anyway,
sometimes it seems that the popular songs of one generation become the art songs of the generations to come.
Yeah, they can be, and some of the Beatles started that with slight classical crossover there.
Well, this evening I know that you're going to be singing a few selections from West Side Story. I'd like to talk a little bit about what it was like for you when you were, you know, recording, mm-hmm. when you were doing the singing for that. You were doing the singing for Natalie Wood, who was cast in the role of mm-hmm. Maria. What did you have to think about when deciding how to sing for her?
Well, usually I take it by what their speaking voice is like and try to extend that. And then I look at their mouths and sort of you can see the structure of what the people look like, and you can almost guess what their voice would sound like if they could sing. You then, of course, hear them sing, and that you have to take their pronunciation, their speech pattern, and translate it into vocal terms. And then it's just a matter of experimenting how to do that, and you have to have a lot of cooperation with the actress in order to do that.
What cooperation do you need from her?
Well, you need to be in her rehearsals. You have to know what she wants to do with the song. You have to really see. It's almost like I used to say, it's like slicing open their head, you know, and reaching in and see the contents of what makes them tick, and really observing that, and then translate it through you. You have to become like a medium.
Well, which comes first on the film? Their lip-syncing rendition of it, or your singing of it?
The ideal way is if you can rehearse the scene so well that then you can go to the recording studio and pre-record the songs, knowing exactly where you're going to be on the set and everything. And then, of course, when you film, you have to it's filmed silently. So you have to film to a track, even if it's your own track. So all the nuances and everything has to be frozen by that time. And and then it's up to the actress, once if you've recorded for her, then to try that on during the rehearsal of a scene and during the filming to make sure it's all right. Sometimes then you have to come back and re-record to earphones if they want to cut out a scene or re-edit. And in the case of West Side Story, they did not know how much of her voice, they hadn't planned how much of her voice would be used, and as a matter of fact, it was very ticklish because they were afraid. They were telling me that my voice was going to be used totally, but they were telling her that I was just going to extend the long notes. So she was actually recording the tracks, and I was just singing the notes that she couldn't sustain, just standing side by side, knowing full well that her voice wasn't good enough. It made me very paranoid because I thought, what if they're treating me like they're treating her? I mean, they were afraid that that her ego wouldn't take it, that if she knew that her voice was going to be thrown out, that she would then not do the rest of the picture. So once they got everything in the can, as they say, then they told her her tracks were going to be thrown out, and now I was going to come back and re-record everything.
How did she take that?
She was very mad, but there was nothing she could do. And then I've talked to her since. I mean, then she accepted the fact. And then once she knows that I'm going to protect her, you know, that I'm supposed to be a part of her, really, and it's not going to be anything that would be opposed to her acting job, then, you know, then eventually the shock wears down and then you see the reasons for it. But that was very difficult because some of the scenes that she did the best acting wise, she wasn't in sync with the track. And so sometimes I had to, when I looked at the film, now I'm re-recording to a loop. They put sections on a loop that comes back and back, and you just keep redoing them until they get right. I had the orchestra in one ear and her singing not quite with the orchestra and sometimes flat in the other ear. And I'm trying to then record, you know, not even hearing myself and with the accent and everything. And what I had to do in some cases was to, on the close-ups, be right with her lips, whether she was with the orchestra or not. But on the long shots, I had to just mess that up a little so that actually I could be exactly with the orchestra and not with her lips.
Sounds like it would be very difficult.
It's very
to
complicated.
Do.
And as a matter of fact, Andre Previn said to me once, he said, you know, Marnie, we didn't hire you for your voice. We hired you for your iron nerves.
Well, we're going to hear an excerpt from the film soundtrack of West Side Story, the duet that you sing with Anita. And do you have any recollections of recording?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, this is not Rita Moreno. It's interesting.
It's not Rita Moreno either?
No, Rita Moreno plays Anita. Rita does some of her own singing in the album. It was dubbed by a woman by the name of Betty Wand, who was singing this duet. And It was, and she also, I do a little bit of Rita Moreno's voice too in the Rumble. So actually she had three voices dubbing for her. But is Rita is a singer. You know, she's a marvelous singer. But these to do a Bernstein score and to do a Bernstein opera, there's a lot of range. It's, you can't just, you know, plan to sing an opera if you really haven't done a lot of operatic singing, and plan to learn it in 6 weeks, which they give you to do a role on film like this. So,
okay, well, let's listen to Marnie Nixon, and Betty Wand was her mm-hmm. name, in an excerpt from the film soundtrack of West Side Story.
A boy like that would kill your brother. Forget that boy and find another. One of your own kind. Stick to your own kind. A boy like that will give you sorrow. You'll meet another boy tomorrow. One of your own kind. Stick to your own kind. A boy who kills cannot love. A boy who kills has no heart. And he's the boy who gets your love and gets your heart. Very smart, Maria, very smart. A boy like that wants one thing only. And when he's done, he'll leave you lonely. He'll murder your love, he murdered mine. Wait and see, just wait, Maria, just wait and see.
Oh, no, Anita, no, Anita, no. It isn't true, not for me. It's true for you, not for me. I hear your words, and in my head, I know they're smart. But my heart, Anita, but my heart. In love, or so you said. You should know better. I have a love, and it's all that I have, right or wrong. What else can I? I'm here.
We've been listening to an excerpt from the film soundtrack of West Side Story. Singing, we heard Marnie Nixon in the role of Maria, and Betty Wan in the role of Anita. You had some job there, Marnie. I mean, you were not only singing for Natalie Wood, but you were singing for Natalie Wood playing the part of a Puerto Rican.
Right.
Which is a really kind of double impersonation to be doing.
Yeah.
Did you have to think about how Natalie Wood, who was white, was acting as a Puerto Rican while you were singing? It's just so double-edged.
No, I just took it from her. Just whatever, you know, that didn't occur to me, you know, whatever. I just accepted her as Maria, but that's what makes it interesting, of course. Really fascinating. Good acting exercises. I must say, I do a lot of teaching and master classes and things, and I can relate to so many different kinds of personalities and singers, and I can teach singing from so many points of view, and I think that experience was part of it. Also, I did a lot of acting when I was a child, besides being a violinist and just straight play, so I could approach it from a lot of different angles.
How did you, like the score for West Side Story? There were, you know, the really dramatic numbers like this one and the one where everyone in the cast sings mm-hmm. Tonight in Counterpoint. And then there's songs like I Feel Pretty, which are just much simpler and lighter and mm-hmm. Redundant in structure.
Well, we used to have this kind of musicianly kind of snobbery when we talk about Bernstein scores. Oh, it's derivative, and it's he's got everything in the sun in it, and blah blah blah. And I never, I mean, that's just playing games. I don't. I never think of it really musically. If it works, if it's organic, and if it can be done over and over and over again, and you don't get sick of it, then you know there's something there. Even if it reminds you of something else. And nowadays I listen to the score and I don't think gave it proper respect. I think it's a marvelous score, and I think it really has weight. And
did you like the score for The King and I, which you also recorded?
Oh, yes. Ugh, I love it. And My Fair Lady.
Were there any special complications in either of those films?
Well, yes. The King and I actually was the easiest. That was the first big one that I had dubbed. And Deborah and I really got along together marvelously. We have the same color hair, and we found out our parentage. My father's family comes from the same place in Scotland as her family. My last name is actually MacEthran. Scottish. Well, Nixon is also my middle name, and that's also a Scottish name, but MacEthran is obviously very Scottish. And we just felt very, very close to each other. As a matter of fact, there was a marvelous picture that Yul Brynner took of us sitting on the recording stage with her in focus and me sitting right next to her. We were both singing the same song, kind of trying it on for size to see if it worked. And our hands were in the same position. Our head was in the same position. You know, it was just a marvelous melding of personalities. And that was very well planned, the whole thing. I rehearsed with her. Every time she rehearsed the scene in which there was a song, in the rehearsal room they lay out the scene, the set on tape to the floor. And so I would get up and stand next to her every time she would start to sing, so that she could take from me the body tensions and energy thrusts that I would do when I actually would sing. She would also be singing, and I would be looking at her, how she would pronounce her words, you know, what happens to her mouth when she does certain notes, where she was headed, the thrust of where she was going, if she'd reach for something, or if she was trying to get a point across, just those little subtle things that we would take, so that actually you could point to one of us and in certain numbers, and I could continue within a measure, and you could never tell the difference who mm-hmm. was singing.
And with Audrey Hepburn?
And with Audrey, it was a little more difficult. First of all, it wasn't planned how much of her singing would be used again, which already makes it difficult. And she was taking voice lessons, which I was also helping with, so that during the filming of the picture, she was actually learning how to sing a particular note better so that she could go in and re-record that note so she could get as much of herself on film as possible. She's a very hard worker and very aristocratic. I mean, marvelous personality. Very careful, everything is very well thought out. But there again, she filmed the Wouldn't It Be Lovely to her track, and then they threw it out and put in my track, which is already more difficult because then I had to, it would have been better if we'd gotten it together, so she could have, there could have been a melding. And her reaction, of course, when that was thrown out was, she said, "Oh," and she walked out of the studio. But that's all she said. But in typical Audrey Hepburn fashion, she came back the next day and she apologized to everybody for her outrageous behavior. I mean, she's such a lady, you know. And but she accepted, you know, the fact. And
I think it's in the film Singing in the Rain where the heroine is actually doing the dubbing for someone who was a great silent film star, but it turns out to have this really squeaky Brooklyn accent and really can't talk at all. Yeah. And at the end of the movie, of course, she's exposed that the beautiful voice is actually the voice of the heroine. Is that Singing in the Rain?
I don't know. Maybe.
That seems to me that's a classic
plot.
Nightmare, yes. You know, of anyone who's singing in a film and the person who's really singing for them isn't credited. It must be, you know, I mean, you didn't receive the credit you should have, but it must have been terribly embarrassing for them, for anyone who really thought
sure.
that they sang,
yeah,
you know,
I think
to be revealed as
I think
not
it must
being
have
able
been
to
hard,
sing that well.
Especially for Audrey, because it was very, by that time it was, you know, they hadn't hired Julie Andrews, and that was already a subject for talking about. The difficulty of that particular thing was, of course, a Cockney. And every Cockney is different, really, according to which block you came from. And they had speech experts, and they had Alan Lerner, and they had George Cukor, and everybody telling me what to do. And then Audrey said, "I don't want to pronounce it, get it set in pronunciation until my father, Stanley Holloway, comes to town and get on the picture." And I would say the pronunciation was the difficulty there, or the mixture of personalities telling you what to do. If they just leave you alone, it would have been much better. But they almost didn't hire me because they heard that I was from California, and so finally they had to have an audition it was like a blind, you know, just by numbers. That made me mad. Why, you know, if I could properly pronounce something, why should they think that somebody from California couldn't do that? It's like the Schoenberg, you know?
Yeah, really.
And so anyway, that was interesting.
Well, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Marnie Nixon, who we're talking about her experiences when she dubbed for Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady, for Deborah Kerr in The King and I, and for Natalie Wood in West Side Story, the films of each of those. In a few minutes, we're going to hear a bit more of her Schoenberg Cabaret song album. But first, we're going to hear a short recording by her son. And her son is Andrew Gold. And maybe you've heard this. This was a hit record, I guess, about a year ago?
Mm-hmm. He's got another hit.
The new hit?
It's his third album, from his third album called Thank You for Being a Friend. And, marvelous songs. When I heard that lonely boy, I was crying.
Really?
Oh, my poor boy, what have I done?
well, as you'll hear, the lyrics is about someone whose parents took great care of him and kind of coddled him, but he was very lonely and he left home and broke away.
Well, he became lonely when his sister was born, you see, and he found out that he wasn't the only one. And I think that's the success of this, because everybody has that experience, you know. It's partly autobiographical, but in part of the song he says, and then my sister grew up and then the cycle and she had a son, except that his sister was born two years after he was born, but she's just recently got married and she doesn't have any children yet.
Okay. Well, let's hear Lonely Boy sung by Andrew Gold, who's the son of my guest, Marnie Nixon.
Mother and father said, what a lovely boy. We'll teach him what we learned. Oh, yes, just what we learned. We'll dress him up warmly and we'll send him to school. It'll teach him how to fight to be.
Listening to Andrew Gold from an album, What's Wrong With This Picture. The song is Lonely Boy, and we're playing it because Andrew Gold is the son of my guest, Marnie Nixon. Marnie, you're, of course, from a classical music tradition. You've also sung, you know, popular songs or sung for movies. Did you expect when you had children that they would kind of develop this intuitive love for classical music or that they would move away from it?
Well, actually, the problem with Andy is that he was so musical. But he was in it around Ernest, who was a composer, and me as a singer, that when he would play, he wanted to play Mozart and Beethoven, but the fact that he had to practice it and he would make a mistake in the second measure of the thing would drive him so crazy he didn't want any part of it. So we just told him to, you know, never mind. And he wanted to do some rock things, so that we said, well, go to your room and leave us alone, you know, if you want to do that kind of music. And we figured a little bit of deprivation would go a long way. You know, if he wanted to play the piano, we'd say, well, you know, just don't bother us. So finally, he started on the guitar, and he started learning things himself, and we had him hooked then. And then he started coming to his father and saying, what chord is this, and how do I write this down? And then he just, he did it all on his own. You know, just really started doing everything. He didn't have guitar lessons or anything. He did have piano lessons for a while, but he learned everything by ear.
So you didn't want to inhibit him by always being the listening ear and commenting on what he was doing?
Oh, no. I mean, he already had such a, you know, an inner sense of criticism because he wasn't as good, that that was his main thing, and we didn't want him to have that.
Did you ever pass judgment on rock and roll, you know?
Oh, I'm sure we all did. But actually, I grew to just love the Beatles, which was his big thing.
Do you listen to his records now?
Oh, yes.
Do you like him?
Yes. My son, the rock star.
Do you go to his concerts at all?
Instead of saying, my son, the doctor.
Yeah, really. It's very different.
Lawyer, I say, my son, the rock star. Oh, yeah. My kids, I drive them crazy. They think I show him off too much. I go to lots of his concerts if I can. Unfortunately, he's so busy, sometimes he doesn't let me know when they're going on. I call his answering service about once a month and say, this is your mother, M-O-T-A-G-R. Sticking my head in the oven already. Don't call me. Please take care of me. You're so rich. I don't know.
Well, Marnie Nixon will be giving a concert this evening in Philadelphia. And she's going to be performing at the Abington Township Adult School. And let me give you a phone number if you'd like to call for concert information about that. It's 659 4284, 659-4284. And can you give us a sense, Marnie, of what you'll be singing on the program this evening?
It's really what I call a crossover. It's a old combination of old favorites, the things I've dubbed, and mostly based on classical things, but a lot of lighter things, too, but very familiar things. It's certainly not going to be Schoenberg or Berg or Ives or Stockhausen or anything.
Okay, what time does the concert start?
8 o'clock.
8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Okay, and again, that's at the Abington Township Adult School. Marnie Nixon, I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I have, too.
My guest has been Marnie Nixon, who has recorded the works of Webern and recently an album of Schoenberg cabaret songs. She's also done the dubbing for the women in three films, West Side Story, My Fair Lady, and The King and I. She's
done
recitals
too.
And opera around the country, performed with many symphony orchestras, and will perform in Philadelphia this evening. We're going to hear, again, excerpts from her album, The Cabaret Songs of Arnold Schoenberg, written between
1893
and 1903. This is from a fairly recent recording on the RCA record label. Marnie Nixon, thank you again for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
We've heard Marnie Nixon sing as recorded on her album of Arnold Schoenberg Cabaret Songs.